part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time. I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time. Fanboy.com.
Let's begin the podcast. My name is Christian Horn. This is the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. I am on the line with Jessica Mason. Jessica Mason is a comic creator, a writer of books as well, screenwriting. And we have Jessica on the line because we are here to talk to her about her new comic called Pistol. Correct, Jessica?
That's right. Hi, Christian.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, I'm excited. Our Pistol, the first issue, is coming out in October 26th, and we're going to launch it at LA Comic Con. So I'm super excited to talk to people about it. Do you want me to tell everyone a little bit about it?
Yeah, well, we had, just to say that we also had you on the podcast a little bit a while ago at the Meet at Meltdown event, like probably, what was that, like a month and a half ago?
Yeah, it was super fun. It was a month and a half ago, and I discovered a new comic book shop, which I was very excited about.
Yeah. It's a shop called Quest in downtown LA. The event was there. So thank you to them for having that event and, you know, us being able to meet each other. But we did do like a small, like little 10-minute interview, and the sound quality could have been better. So I wanted to have you back on the show to talk about your book because I really like the sort of ideas and themes that this book is exploring. So yeah, if you want to tell people a little bit about what it is about, what Pistol is about, that'd be great.
Okay. Well, Pistol is a vigilante superhero, and it's spelled like the flower, not the gun.
Yeah.
And yeah, she is... she's Mexican and she escaped sex trafficking as a child. But when she did that, she did it with the help of her ancestors, Las Adelitas, these kind of vengeful, powerful warrior women who helped her escape the brothel. And when she got to America, she befriends Hudson, who is a really, he actually has autism, but he's a really good hacker. And his their family takes her in. And she starts to kind of deal with her trauma and kind of repress these supernatural beings because they really want violence. She wants to help other survivors. And so they go along trying to do something kind of like Anonymous did with Steubenville. And expose criminals, and what ends up happening is a young rape victim commits suicide that she was trying to help, and the next she goes back to the town to try to deal with the kids that did this to her, and they are going to do the offense again, and so she goes off the rails and becomes a vigilante that night and does kill some people. And then she is now, you know, in this issue that's coming up, she's a full-fledged vigilante who's been fighting sex trafficking rings and different kinds of crimes with Hudson's help. And Mira, the girl that she saves that first time, has now become an LAPD cop. And they kind of have a Batman, well, they'll eventually have a Batman Commissioner Gordon kind of relationship.
Yeah.
And that was a long version of it. I did not do the short pitch. Sorry.
No, it's totally. Well, we have time, so it's good for the long pitch. It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I did get issue 0 and 1 at the Made It Meltdown. And 0 is sort of like a prequel, sets up some of what you were talking about. And then issue 1 sort of definitely gets to the like nitty gritty of the happenings in the book. I found this to be I really think it addresses some really great social problems that we're having in our society that people sort of are not necessarily paying attention to or are not necessarily in the foreground of the news. I think back when we chatted a little bit, you did give me a bit of a background about like why you wanted to sort of make a book like this, but let's chat about that again and maybe go a little bit more in depth, because there's definitely a lot of things that that I find interesting about this, and why, like, how did you sort of come across these issues? Like, what is it about them? I mean, obviously it's a stupid question. What is it about them that, you know, touched you and wanted you to make a story addressing them? But I guess those are some of the sort of general questions that I have to start off with.
Okay. Well, you know, all women and a lot of men too have some kind of personal story that connects to sexual assaults, whether they, you know, were part, like whether they witnessed one, whether their friend told them about one, whether they experienced one. And, you know, initially I'm just going to start with this story and then I'll kind of go into maybe some more personal stuff a little bit further into the interview. But what really, I worked with young people in Los Angeles and a lot of these who had been homeless before. And a lot of these kids have dealt with this kind of subject matter, you know, on the streets, whether it is assault of some kind, witnessing it, someone assaulting their mom, being assaulted themselves, possibly being trafficked. And I remember coming home and just feeling very frustrated. And sure. as a screenwriter, you know, I wrote kind of a 15-minute short, which was more of a professional kind of thing way, way, way back when I was doing that kind of work. And, then I remember Steubenville happened, and I don't know, since I don't know if everybody knows about Steubenville, I'll kind of give a, in Ohio, there was a small town and two football players raped a young girl at a party. And what was different about this is that there was a ton of social media involved in this. A lot of the kids from the party posted about the rape, posted photos, made comments. It was clear that something bad had happened.
Sure.
The town and it in what, you know, seemed to be happening, it was like no one wanted to ruin these young men's life.
Yeah.
They wanted to cover it up.
Yeah.
Different, and I'm not going to start naming names because, you know, a lot of it's hearsay, some of it's not. But, you know, certain members of the, you know, staff at the high school, certain members of the community were, you know, actively not pursuing this case.
Yeah.
And then Anonymous, who, you know, I have both pros and cons to say about things about them. I think we all know about Anonymous. It's the hacking group that sure. has no leader, and they kind of have become more and more political.
Yeah.
And
not
I think
political enough, in my opinion. But anyway, go ahead.
Well,
tax
were,
returns. I'll just say tax returns.
Tax anyway, returns would have been nice, right?
Yeah,
for sure.
Exactly.
And they in Steubenville, they got involved, and particularly this man named Derek Lostutter, I believe. I don't want to say his name wrong, but okay. They started kind of leading the charge and trying to figure out what happened to this young girl and why it was being covered up. And Anonymous put a ton of pressure on this town and this community, for better or for worse. And it became a media kind of frenzy.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I don't know, some of those things, you don't know if they were if they made the victim's life better or worse. I mean, I'm not going to really weigh in on that.
Yeah.
But I remember just being so angry that Anonymous had to do this. You
yeah.
know, I'm like, and what got it really interesting in the aftermath of that case is, yes, both the boys ended up getting, like, they both got under 2 years for the assault, and everyone, Jeez. There was a lot of people who bemoaned you're ruining their lives. And, you know, the truth is, I think someone on Gawker, it was a writer and I can't remember her name, you know, made a statement. A lot of us feel you didn't ruin their lives. They committed a crime.
Yeah.
They got the consequences. They had to serve their time and they'll go on with their lives, and their lives changed because they did something rotten.
Yeah.
And so
they did it to themselves. I mean, honestly,
they did it to themselves, like the young girl. And the thing about, and there was another case around that same time. And this thing went viral. It was like this weird position. People would put themselves on the ground. It was like a joke, but this girl had passed out at a party and had been assaulted, and it was a picture of her. And that was something, I'm sorry, I just went off on a side thing, but around the same time, I was just getting so frustrated with one, what was happening online was sexual assault and sex trafficking. It was taking on a whole new life, you know, and it was frightening to me. This was my 20s before this stuff was percolate, not my 20s. Well, who knows? Maybe in my 30s. I don't know what I'm saying. But basically, I found it really interesting that the government really went after Anonymous after this case, because I think what Anonymous did here, it frightened them, because they did hack the high school website, football team website. They got involved and they kind of flexed their, I feel like it was, I might be wrong, but it seemed like the first time they kind of flexed a a muscle that freaked out the DOG for sure. DOJ, excuse me. And so anyways, I was really in, and the guy, Derek actually got sentenced to 2 years, I think in May 2018, I want to say, or 2017, for his involvement in that. And he was the one who was trying to expose the rapist. So he ended up getting more time than both the boys. So I found that case very like disheartening, but I think it's because it made me think of a case that happened, and I wouldn't call it a case, but happened to a friend of mine in high school, basically. And it pulled, it just brought that all back. Cause I was like, oh, that's totally what happened to my friend. And I'm not going to name her cause she never wanted to talk about it. But it, to this day, and I'm 40 years old, it makes me angry to think about those boys and those kids that were involved in it, and that they never had any consequences. I mean, maybe they had personal consequences. Maybe they've always felt bad about it. But you know, they never had faced any justice. And I just started thinking about all of these kids, and like, and you started hearing about Boko Haram, you know, internationally, and then, you know, Malala gets shot, you know, for trying to go to school. And you just, I started getting so angry all the time. And as a writer, I'm like, this is really unhealthy. Like, I can't just be angry all the time. I need, you know, write my senator and write people so many letters. And then I'm like, I need to do something creatively. And so I had been going to comic cons, and I'd never written a comic book before. And I really liked the comic book world. I was, I mean, I'd always read comics, but I'd never really gone to cons, and I never really had met a bunch of comic book professionals before.
What started you going to cons?
Well, my friend, TJ, who I've been friends with since we were like 15 years old, he discovered the professional passes. And that was like, oh, let's go to, you know, I got a professional badge. I have a guest pad badge. Why don't you come with me? And I'm like, yeah, I'll come with you. And I went to San Diego, and I just was like,
dived in deep right away.
And it was a lot of fun. And I just got really up. And then I had my, I have a writing partner who I did screenwriting with, and we had a script called Deep Thirst, which I still love. And this is still a plan I have to make into a comic book. And she mentioned that we should turn it into a comic book. And it just, at that, those two things kind of happened at the same time. And I was like, oh, this character I've been thinking about and this issue I've been wanting to write about is perfect for comic books. And part of it also plays into Gamergate, which is, I know, like video games, but these worlds that are traditionally male and not always welcoming to women. And I'm not saying I've had great experiences with science fiction and video games and comic books, but it is one of those, they're all, those worlds are not necessarily open arms to girls, especially in the like late 70s and 80s when I grew up. And so I liked coming into a world where it, I don't know, screenwriting's pretty hard for women too, but you know, like it just felt like the right place, you know, to tell this story. And I didn't see, I mean, there's Jessica Jones, right? Who was a survivor as well. But that was like the only comic book that I could think of. And it didn't necessarily deal with trafficking specifically. Is a huge concern I haven't got into, but I wanted, the reason I kind of brought in small town, basically party rape, I don't know, the rape culture and connected it with international sex trafficking, is that I think our complicity as a society in both of those crimes is very connected. It's that we don't want to talk about it. We know that it happens, but it's like all this, it involves abuse of on all levels. You know, it's, we see it in the Catholic Church, and it's just, you know, it's like, just don't want to deal with it. I feel like it's so ugly, we don't want to deal with it. So we like make up excuses for the people who commit the crimes. And I'm just like, have to change that dialogue. Cause it's, and I thought we were changing it. That's like Steubenville to me was like one of those moments where I felt we were, that's when I felt like it kind of started this, you know, conversation that has slowly been evolving to Me Too and where we are right now, which I'm very unsure of where we are right now after last week and Brett Kavanaugh. we'll see.
No, it's interesting because as a as a dad of a daughter, and I mean, and these are the stupid things that men say, like, oh, I have a daughter, you know, I have a mom, I have things like that. But I was raised by a single mom as well, and have a sister and stuff like that. So I think that for me, in a way, and I'm not saying that I'm this incredibly open, liberated, perfect man. I'm not. I have my male faults, you know, but I definitely think I have a bit of a different sort of perspective than quote unquote your average male, because of the way I was raised and things like that. And I actually have, one of my best friends has daughters as well. And we'll get logged into these like chat conversations with each other, like texting conversations, where we're just talking about statistics and how scared we are, and like all the things that even before this Me Too stuff started. And it is definitely a thing that's always been sort of at the forefront of my mind, because when I was young, I had a girlfriend in college, and she was assaulted by somebody in her family, and she let me know, and the person in her family was still living in the house. And I was just like, what do you, like, as a sort of like around 19 years old, you know, it's like, what do you, like, what can you, this is the most insane thing I've ever, you know, been involved in, you know?
Yeah.
It's just interesting to me how the culture of like victimizing people and anger and sort of like damage and aggressiveness, it's just starting to come. It's starting to be revealed and shown for what it is. And it's interesting because you see a lot of women in the Me Too movement, and it's like, it doesn't have to be this way. And for so long with men, it's like, no, this is the way it is. There is war, there is anger, there is, you know, and this is kind of just the way society is. And I think that what's happening now is that there are a lot of people out there who have either been assaulted or victimized in some way, who are going like, and because of the technological advances and everything that we've made in communications, there's a lot of people going like, why does it have to be this way? Why do we have to fight wars? Why do we have to victimize people? And I think it's like a sort of slow awakening that's happening. And obviously it's not happening fast enough, but I think it's there to look at it sort of from a positive perspective. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it seems like with social advancement, you always have to take like 10 steps back to make one step forward, you know, regarding, when you're talking about like Kavanaugh and Trump and like all this ridiculous nonsense that they're enabling I don't know. I just kind of went on my own little rant there.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. I didn't want to talk.
No, go ahead.
With Trump and with a lot of the anger toward the Me Too movement and this feeling that young men are now not safe because they might be accused
that's
of
ridiculous.
Bad behavior, is, you know, the chances of that happening in a like acquaintance experience, like a date rape experience, or somebody that you know, that you misidentify a person or you accuse them just to get back to them, is just the statistic. Statistically is very low.
Yeah.
And just scientifically, mathematically, it's silly. I mean, of course it happens to some people.
Yeah.
Of course there's like a few mentally unstable people in the world who accuse people of crazy things that they didn't do, but that's just not the majority of cases or the reality of it. And the idea that someone like Dr. Ford would come forward. It's so ridiculous to me that some woman would ruin her life and have to move and go through that just to attack a man to stop him from getting, and like that she would be carrying that kind of a resentment. I mean, most women don't talk about the bad things. Yeah. And just the idea that, and then how angry everybody gets, you know. When I watched Brett Kavanaugh give his testimony, I could have just watched that and said, wow, you know, that's so aggressive, that's so angry, that's so Donald Trump, right? You're up for a Supreme Court justice nomination and you are having a tantrum, basically. Then when Lindsey Graham joins in and has a tantrum, I was just so shocked. I thought I would turn to the news and hear, wow, he lost it.
Yeah.
And we have to have a new, you know, new person. And that's not what happened. And I do think it sent an interesting message to women, to yeah. both sides. I mean, there's women on both sides are having different reactions, obviously. Yeah. So we're not all aligned.
Sure. Yeah. I totally agree with you on everything that you've just said. I was shocked as well. I was stunned. I mean, that the emotional testimony of Dr. Ford would be followed up by something like that. And then that the media would be like, or certain segments of the media would be like, oh, he had a very strongly worded retort and his testimony was very powerful. And I was like, it was unhinged. Like, yeah. And it just shows you the lens that you see sort of male aggressiveness through, or that people see. I remember when I was younger, and you know, we're obviously getting a little political, and we should get back yeah. to talking about your book, you know, which is fine. I don't care because my book's a little
political. So yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, and that's totally fine. I'm a political person. If you look at the Part-Time Fanboy Twitter feed, I'm always sharing stuff as well. But for me, it was a really shocking reminder as to how much male aggression is sort of like accepted in society and how it's just sort of seen as the norm for men. And I remember in the 80s, my own mother, when Reagan was running for president, and even when I was a teenager, a kid, I was very sort of little liberal as well, her talking about how we needed somebody strong. You need somebody strong and with strength. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the thing is, you know, okay, Reagan was strong, but he also did not talk like an unhinged teenager, you know, yeah. Entitled to a seat on the Supreme Court just because somebody, you know, gave him a nomination. So those are definitely things that stick out to me. And, you know, in this moment as to how, you know, anger and aggressiveness and that sort of thing have sort okay. of been just exposed as a sort of normal thing, when a lot of the time society actually wants you to, you know, go to your job, blend in, don't be too angry, but then when you see something like that by a person in power or a person who might wield power, it's totally acceptable. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it's okay to go to war, you know, when there's not necessarily concrete evidence or those sort of things. And yeah, and those are very much like, I agree with you 100%. It's to me, it was very shocking. And it's just shocking to me to see what a lot of people are using as sort of like kickback to the Me Too movement. And I'm like, really? Like, that's okay now? Like, we're okay with this? Like, you know, even the white supremacy movement kind of like trying to build up and like come back. And I'm like, I thought we were done with this. Like, we're still doing this? Like, you know, I thought, you know, when I read comics in the 80s and 70s about Captain America fighting Nazis, and now you've sort of like got Comicsgate, you know, being, you yeah. know, kind of like leaning in that direction, although they deny that they are. Yeah. I'm just like, what? Like, did you not read any X-Men comics? Like, I'm astounded by it.
It's always very interesting to me where people and it's we get into like rage and misogyny and how men and women can experience these things differently. And with like Comicsgate and, you know, Gamergate and all that stuff. And even in the science fiction writing world, I mean, you see a backlash when it's cool when there's one girl hanging out doing it, you know, and if she's doing it your way and digging the things that you like and acting like a guy and writing about guy things, you know, or whatever traditional guy things are, it's cool.
Yeah.
And then when women enter a space and have a different point of view, that's when you start to see pushback and the misogyny come in, because yeah. people will be like, oh, I'm not sexist. And I'm like, but you are, you're not sexist when a woman agrees with you, yeah. then you want to empower her. But when a woman disagrees with you, that's when you're tested,
yeah.
you know, and that's when we're all tested, right? How we treat people when they disagree with us, you know, and one of those things that I kind of am exploring in Pistol is female rage.
Yeah.
And what is, and that's even the play on the name, you know, like Pistol is like a part of the flower that gives life, but it's also can sound like a gun, right?
Yeah. And that was a really nice play on words, by the way. I'll give you a compliment on that. I liked it.
Thank you. And part of it is through the first story arc in the first six or seven comics of Pistol. I'm exploring, you know, her dealing with the rage and trauma and having that reaction, having a very violent reaction to it. And then also dealing with, you know, wanting to handle it a better way. You know what I mean? Is there a better way than killing all of these horrible people? Cause some days I don't feel like there is.
And I
don't mean, and I'm not saying like Brett Kavanaugh. Okay. Just to be clear, I'm talking about really bad.
We're not advocating violence towards anyone on this podcast. Exactly.
No. It's my comic. My character is a vigilante. She does kill people. But she tries not to, and the dialogue is constantly happening between her and Hudson and internally about the violence and what to do with it. You know, when is it the right time to eliminate a person that is committing these atrocities against young women and young men? And when is it not okay? When do you need to, it's actually never okay, but she is talking about, that is what we're exploring in Pistol.
Yeah. Like, and it's a fantasy world, you know, it's an environment, you know, I mean, apparently there have also been stories this week about Jamie Lee Curtis, like using a gun in a new Halloween movie. And there's all these like activists being like, oh, well you're anti-gun, but you're using a gun in the movie. And it's like, it's a movie, jackass. Like, you know, it's like, we don't really, you know, I mean, that's sort of the thing that I think.
You can be a gun activist and care about gun control and still hold a gun. I mean, it's silly. It's like, I mean, I have all my family, they're hunters. They're from Michigan, you know, and that's fine to me. I mean, but it's not fine to me for everyone to have, you know, certain kinds of weapons. I'm not going to get all into that today, of course you can use weapons and art without being a hypocrite.
Yeah.
Your personality.
Yeah. Well,
and also if Mike Myers is coming after you, I mean, what are you supposed to do?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, just on a practical level.
Exactly. What are you going to use? Like a plastic knife? Yeah. It's not going to work.
Knife fight with him. You're not going
to
win.
Well, she used a coat hanger in the first one, but that's all she had available to her. I'm sure she stocked up since then.
That was an amazing scene. That was
Oh, it's a great movie. But talk to me a little bit about developing sort of the vigilante aspect and that sort of thing. I mean, obviously, we've got characters like that in comics, like DC and stuff like this. But this is a little bit of a more sort of like Punisher sort of leaning character. How did this sort of develop in your mind to actually make like a hardcore sort of Death Wish style vigilante?
Well, I knew originally when I started writing the story, she was an assassin character from the very beginning.
Okay.
But then I didn't like that. It was more like, you know, an outlaw Josie Wales or a professional just kind of falls into a situation and then becomes this, almost like an everyday person in a way, but she was an assassin who falls into these issues and has to confront them. And I liked that idea because she didn't have an emotional connection with it, but I quickly moved on to this idea. Like, I wanted her always to be Mexican, or I wanted to combine like Mexico with rural America.
Well, let me ask you about that, because we've met sort of in person, and I mean, I'm of Latino heritage, and a lot of people don't recognize that right away because I am, you know, light skinned, light eyed and stuff like that. But you did not physically seem to me to fit sort of the stereotype. So why did that develop in your mind as to why you wanted to sort of focus on Latinos or Latinx or sort of Mexicans as sort of like, or a Mexican protagonist?
Well, I wanted this to be kind of a Los Angeles, Mexico story. But one thing that was very important to me was that, I wanted to connect like what was happening in the Midwest in a traditionally white community with what was happening internationally, maybe in, you know, in Mexico and Central America. But part of the reason is a lot of the young people that I worked with, in LA, are, you know, are Mexican American, are Mexican. And I didn't like this idea of my character being like going into Mexico as a white savior kind of thing. I was not comfortable with that. And you know, cause whenever I worked with young people, I was never trying to save them. I was just trying to listen to them and figure out what we could do to help their community. You know, it's you have to hear people, you have to get the answers from them. You don't want to come in and, you know, be that person. And it was important to me that the vigilante herself was Mexican. Sure. And then it was important for me that Commissioner Gordon was white. And so I did care about race in that aspect. And then, and Hudson is African American. I just really want representation in my comic books. I don't like to just see something really, one way or another. I like to see lots of different backgrounds and races. And so, but that comes with its own things. You want to make sure that you're doing it right. And you don't want to, you know, take over anyone's story. So it makes it a little more complicated, but
is there anyone that you sort of consulted with, like as you were writing the book? Did you show somebody like, oh, hey, am I being too, you know, whatever, insensitive or that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, I have a couple friends that I do talk to for sure to make sure that I'm being sensitive. And then also, now Lonnie is not Mexican, but she's Caucasian and she's also Guatemalan.
Sure.
She's the artist. And Lonnie, her art in general is kind of, she was my first choice. She'd never done a comic either, but the art that I had seen that she had done, I really wanted part of that in the story. And so her and I worked together for quite a long time before we actually started drawing this, just kind of talking about what aspects of, the culture, you know, we were going to pull in and which ones we weren't. And, you know, part of it was the plants too. I know that sounds silly, but
no.
I mean, the background with, you know, her mom was a curandera, and the idea of using plants and, herbs to, you know, connect with your ancestors, to connect with the spirits, to connect with your community and healing and using that was very important. It becomes important. It's not the driving force of the comic. It's kind of an emotional through line for the character, but that was also important. And I liked the desert plants and the things like that. So, yeah.
Sure. Were there any actual stories like in the news? I mean, you seem very sort of connected to like what's been happening. Is there anything that you directly sort of might have pulled from to develop the background of the main character of Pistol? Because, I mean, it's definitely some hardcore stuff. And I was like, oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, if you've been paying attention a little bit to like what's been happening on our borders and stuff like that. But was there anything sort of specific that stuck out to you? Any particular stories or?
There wasn't a specific story. There was something I remembered from when I was a young person that always stuck with me. And I was 16 and the first country I ever went to was Mexico.
Okay.
And I totally went with my church and it was, you know, I'm not super religious, but I went to church and they went on a trip to Mexico and they were just doing puppet shows. And I wanted to go to Mexico. I'm like, Dad, can I please go? And he's like, and, you know, and he's like, yeah. And he let me go, which blew my mind actually. And we went for 2 weeks and, we went to this and it was wonderful and it was a good time, at least for me, but it was eye opening to see the difference in my experiences versus, and then also the similarities, you know, and I related really well with the children. Cause I mean, I was 16, so I wasn't that old and I played with them mostly and we did puppet shows and, but we went to this one village and I have no idea where we were, but it was like up, it was really secluded and there was no women there.
Oh,
like,
wow.
No, it was all men. And we actually didn't stay. It was the only place we kept going because we had all these church partners and there was no church there. We were supposed to go there and do a show. And the guy who was leading the whole thing basically said that, I think he got freaked out. And I don't know what's true or not true because it was a long time ago, but it seemed to be implied that the women had all been taken.
Oh my God.
It was a really small village. It was like, it wasn't big. You know what I mean? I'm not talking like a little town, I'm talking super small. And I didn't know, it felt very dramatic to me. And I still don't know, you know, you don't know you experience things as a 16-year-old, you know, and you don't, but that always stuck with me. And then you started to see the headlines with, what was going down in Central America, what's been going, I mean, and I don't think that sex trafficking is a problem that's outside the United States. I think the United States is there. I want to be very clear. It's very involved in this. It's very involved in the comic. But there is a trail going, you know, kids are being taken from all different kinds of towns and cities and small villages across the whole world, you know, and you see like these terrorist groups kidnap these girls, you know, and take them as wives. And you're like, we have to do something. You can't just, you know, and people will be like, oh, what's happening to these young African-American girls in Washington, D.C.? And you're like, well, they're being lured away and they're being trafficked. And you know, and so I guess that's kind of, you know, I think when you just see it in other countries, it seems more violent and sudden sometimes. But that was really all that was about, is just how easily you can be taken against your will. I mean, not that it's like you have to be afraid all the time, but that when you live in a more isolated place, it's more dangerous, you know, and more atrocities can happen until people realize what's happening. And so, I don't know, now I've gone off, I'm rambling, but but I definitely really wanted, but the thing that I remember about when I was in Mexico is that it was so beautiful. You know, we're up in the, it was gorgeous. All the communities were wonderful. There was a ton of poverty, but it would depend on where you were going, right? Like right on the border was really bad. And then like you went in and then there would be beautiful villages, beautiful churches. And then, you know, so I kind of saw her little town as a small little place where there wasn't a lot of people. Yeah. And that when a bad element came through, they were unprotected.
Yeah.
And that's the main reason why that's how Pistol's story goes, is that, because she lived in a nice community. She didn't live in a bad community, and she just unfortunately had a bad element started to come through her way, which is kind of how I experienced the news about what's happening, you know, in Central America and in Mexico and coming up through into the United States, is that, you know, you get in the wrong path. Like if a gang decides that, you know, or a cartel decides that they're going to be part of your town, it's kind of hard to get them out. So I mean,
no, I mean, it's all part of the book. And just, I mean, how much of a deep, you worked with people, kids in LA, but how much of a deep dive of research were you doing into the particular sort of like, into sex trafficking and the cartels and all that sort of thing that was happening, you know, between the US and Mexico? I'm assuming you read a lot because you seem like the type of person that,
I've read a lot, and it gets a little overwhelming because then you, because there are days if you read too much about these cartels that you will be traumatized. You know, I mean, it's something I don't like to say. I mean, cause there is definitely, you know, I mean, it's hard cause you read especially when there's a big bust. I mean, you've got like Los Angeles, Houston, Atlanta, they're big, you know, big cities that have like issues with, you know, having a lot of girls that are being trafficked running through them, you know, and when they do a big bust and you read about it and you do the research and you research how these cartels, like, you know, in different gangs, and they're all the kind of interconnected, there's a lot of interconnection. I've done a lot of research. I'm trying not to like talk about specific cartels.
I appreciate that.
Not because I'm afraid of them, but not, but I don't want to be like, there's this one group that is like, know, and this one, nationality that is causing all the problems. Cause I don't think that it is. I think, you know, I'm more concerned with the demand aspect of it, honestly. You know, I always say criminals are going to rise up and meet whatever demand there is, you know, because they want to survive and make money, and they're, you know, and I don't think that justifies it, of course, but what's up with the demand, you know? But and the fact that we don't, and that's another thing that I try to balance, like dealing with the suppliers of, you know, the actual traffickers, but also dealing with, as a culture and a society, why is there such a high demand for, you know, this kind of thing? And how's everyone should be accountable, you know, like, you know, you can't, we say that with drugs sometimes, like, well, you know, you're like, oh, these drug traffickers and, you know, these gangs are taking over. And I'm like, yeah, but everyone's doing drugs. So
it's such a farce. It's like such a horrible, horrible dance that we've been in since like the 80s, like, which is, you know, obviously causes ripple effects in society and hasn't done much to help anything, but the people who are behind the money and, you know, and the government and stuff like that. But I wanted to go back a little bit to talk about the vigilante sort of superhero aspect of it, because there's definitely a part of me that is like, I mean, obviously I like the book. I love the concept. I love everything, you know, about it, but I'm wondering like, why superheroes? Why not like, you know, FBI or cops or something like that? Why embrace this sort of like superhero vigilante thing? Is it just because it's comics and superheroes seem to be like the thing that people drift towards? Or was it like a character that just popped into your head and you were like, I've got to do this, like that sort of thing? Am I making sense with that question?
Yes. Yeah. Well, when I write, I do a lot of different kinds of writing. So I write in like, I write novels, I write, this will be my first comic, but I write screenplays. And when I come up with a character, you know, I pick the medium that, you know, I pick the best where I think she's best, you know, or he's best. Sure. And I mean, I do have cops in here, and I have talked to some Los Angeles detectives about sex trafficking, you know, and I had a few years with Special Victims Unit, you know, as a lot of women have, and then we have to give it up because it's, you know, fills you with horror and dread. And it's also kind of a weird, like, guilty plot. I don't know. It's like you like to see that bad guy get caught.
Sure.
You like him to be held accountable because it doesn't happen enough. I do think there's enough procedural, you know, straight cop things, and they don't interest me to write them. I like to watch them. I mean, I wish I didn't love true crime like I do. I'm trying to get off of it, but
why get off of it?
It's so weird. It's such a weird, it's not weird, but it is a little dark.
People love it. I mean, the highest rated TV shows are like those cop dramas, right?
Yeah. And you know, a lot of my research, I do listen to a lot of true crime, and I listen to like almost every podcast that is about true crime. And, I think of it as research half the time, you know, 'cause it's like, I need to know the horrible things that are going on. But, I had to take a break for a while. I did take a couple month break. But back to why I picked a vigilante, and, you know, I spent a lot of time actually even talking to Lonnie, the artist, about it, of how far I wanted her to go and what I wanted her to accomplish.
Yeah.
And, I really needed her to take it one step further, at least in the origin story, than I think some people would, because I wanted to, so I had a long talk about how to end that. I don't know if I should talk about the ending of my comic.
Don't spoil anything.
I won't. So I took a long time deciding how to end that first origin story comic, which is the first time she crosses the line and kills somebody. Uh-huh. And I wanted her to go further than I think anyone should go, because I wanted her to be kind of out of control of herself. Like, she has put this trauma that she has gone through. I mean, you have to imagine she was trafficked for 2 years by this cartel.
Yeah.
And at a very young age, and she she just runs away. She, you know, is on the streets in Texas, and luckily runs into a nice person for a difference. She runs into
it
a
happens.
Good, yeah. Yeah. And, but if she hadn't run into a good person and she ran into a, you know, what would normally happens, it would have just started all over in the US. It wouldn't have been any different. And, but she doesn't really ever personally deal with her trauma and her loss, and getting her to that point is part of the point of this comic book. Right now, she's just dealing with the anger and the rage and the injustice of it all. And I need her to be like a Batman like character, but more, you know what I mean? Like more violent, more a little, I mean, not that there are versions of Batman in comics. So let me, but like the traditional idea of Batman, that he has a line, 'cause I know there's been ones where he crosses that line but he used to have a line. There used to be a line.
Well, so those of us who want that version of Batman, there's a line for sure.
majority of the story.
Yeah. Let me ask you about Batman, though, because there are sort of like Batman-esque. You've said that there's like going to be or might be a character that develops into sort of a Commissioner Gordon thing. And I just because I'm versed in comics and have read way too many comics in my lifetime.
And more
probably,
than I have, I'm sure.
Maybe. But I was just wondering, it's like, how much of a fan of Batman are you? How much, obviously there's an influence, but how much of it did you go like, oh, I love Batman. Like, I want my character to sort of be like Batman. I mean, you said that in the last couple of sentences, but
yeah,
obviously was there like, oh, you know, or is it just that sort of type of, you know, Punisher, Batman sort of thing that you thought would work well for this book? Does that make sense?
Yes. The way I did think about Batman quite a bit. I don't think she's very Batman-esque in her personality necessarily.
No. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It was important to me that she came, I mean, in a couple versions of the script, she kind of pokes fun at Batman a couple times because she comes from no money. She comes from nothing. Yeah. She had to save herself from a very bad situation. Mm-hmm. She started on the streets at that point when she was in the US. And, you know, she's the opposite of Batman in that way. What they share in common is that they had a young trauma and they lost a parent and they don't have their parents. And that's about it, because she has to make her own resources to fight crime. You know,
which is kind of more interesting to me in a way. Yeah.
So she's not like Batman in that way. The only reason I'm talking about, but she does have a sense of righteousness like Batman.
Sure.
Where she knows better than the police. She knows better than, you know, and that's what Hudson and her have debates about sometimes, is that she thinks she's above the law in this particular sense, in this particular world. So she's going to determine who is punished, like the Punisher, and who is not punished. And then she has a supernatural element, which is not like Batman at all. So she does have actual superpowers. However, you could question whether or not they're actually there or not, if you want, you know?
Yeah, that's
another element. Like, are they real? Are they not real? Or is she just like, you know, and we'll find out.
But
so there's definitely, you know, I'm a Batman fan, but not crazy, you know, not.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, everyone's kind of a Batman fan, let's be realistic.
The relationship with the police officer, it's the only one that I have in other comics. That's the best one I can reference, is Batman. Sure. So that may be, unless there's another comic, which there probably is, that has that relationship.
I can't think of one off the top of my head. Talk to me a little bit about sort of the development of the artwork, because I mean, as I was looking through the book and reading it, it's definitely its own sort of unique style. But the thing that I've noticed the most is that this is a book that sort of deals with, you know, very dark sort of complex issues, and the coloring, particularly, like, I've got the covers like right in front of me, is very bright, you know, brightly colored and beautiful, you know, like reds and yellows and stuff like that. On the issue that I have, I think it's a variant cover. She's got, you know, indigo purples and stuff like that. How did you, and it's Lonnie Watson, correct? We haven't said her full name.
It's Lonnie Watson and Mark Mactel. And now issue zero, the one, is the green cover, the one that you're holding right now?
Yeah, with the flowers and she's got sort of flames in the background.
Yeah.
She's like half skull, half, yeah.
So Alani comes from more of like a muralist, a different kind of art background. This is her first comic as well.
Sure.
So when we went through this first comic in this process together, her and I started sitting down and I brought a bunch of comics and different things that I was interested in. And, you know, we had both read the script and we sat down and we would just sit down and talk and panel each page out how we wanted it to look. And discuss different influences. And, you know, part of the style is based on the way her art background. But I didn't want it to be, I do want it to be dark, but I didn't want the art necessarily to be super, you know,
sure.
heavy.
There's a contrast. Yeah,
yeah, there's a contrast. And they, and it is kind of, and when I first was selling it, I kept going, kids kept picking it up. I'm like, nope.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was wondering the most about. Yeah, yeah.
Now we did make it. Now you don't have the version because the, if you have, do you have both the comics, the hard?
I have, well, I have zero and I have one. And because I had one, I didn't download the digital version that you sent me. So I didn't get a chance to see it, but.
No, and one's a little, you have the one variant that I had for that Meltdown event, which was kind of a sample run. We changed the size of the lettering. So it's not, it's smaller lettering.
Oh, okay.
We at first, the first comic we made a conscious choice to do larger lettering than the industry standard. And we had a long talk about it. We just,
why was that?
I'm still like not sure.
Really?
I'm sure. We wanted it to have its own feel and vibe. We didn't want it to look like a traditional comic. We wanted it to be more of kind of our own experiment. And so we wanted it to be bigger. We made that choice. And then, but that's because it's the origin story.
Yeah.
And we did, we went back and forth on it a lot. And then for this one, I realized that I wanted it to be smaller and cause it's like, it made it look too, what's the word too, for kids, I guess.
Gotcha.
And I didn't want it to look like that now cause it's 8 years later and she's, kind of a more of a hardened vigilante. And so, yeah, I mean, but a lot of the coloring, like Mark and Lonnie and I will all sit down and we just kind of talk about, you know, what kind of vibe we're going for each one. But yeah.
Gotcha. There's definitely, it's weird because I noticed that there are, it seems like the style changes a little bit too in some sequences. Does it?
Yeah. So we're working. So this is, as we said, we at the first comic, Lonnie drew everything.
Yeah.
And then Mark did the inking and the coloring.
Yeah.
Then he did a few variant versions of Pistol. Uh-huh. And then in this, what we decided for the rest of the comics that we're going to do is that Mark draws a lot of the present day action stuff and Lonnie does the flashbacks and Hudson and Lita in the apartment.
Uh-huh.
And so blending two artists together. So that's where you're seeing the difference in style. So when you go through issue one, you will see Lonnie's work in the flashbacks and then you'll see Mark's work in the present.
Gotcha.
And Lonnie's work. Yeah. So it is, it's very different. Cause I mean, I've seen comics where they switch artists. Like I think Hackslash, I remember would switch artists, but not within one comic.
Sure.
It's something we're developing.
Yeah.
So this was the first one that we did like that. And we're working on three right now. And so we're doing the same thing and hopefully it just keeps getting better and more.
Gotcha.
Streamlined.
There was a bell there that I heard. I don't know what that was.
It's my text that comes to my computer and I forgot.
It's totally fine. No, it's totally fine. So how many issues of Pistol are there going to be?
There's going to be seven for sure.
Seven. So it's a limited series for sure.
It's a limited series in that I'm going to finish those seven for sure.
It's like you're determined. I'm going to finish it.
Because I have a complete story arc that I want to finish and then I'm going to turn into a trade. And then that trade I will go through like, you know, the bigger distribution, you know. But I have a complete, like it could go on forever, but I have seven that I want to tell for sure. And
that's great.
And then we'll see where it goes from there. I have, because I have a film background, I don't know why I can't talk here. A lot of like where I am with Pistol right now is I am definitely reaching out to my film people and trying to get it optioned somewhere, because I am starting to think it should be a limited, I at first thought a movie, but I actually think maybe a limited TV series run, like, you know, it's just contained and is going to be the story that it is. So,
Are you reaching out to any of like any like sort of telenovela companies and stuff like that? It seems like, you know, on Netflix, there's like a lot of that stuff happening and debuting. I don't know how it shows up on my feed, because when I was a kid, I hated that stuff with when my grandmother used to watch it. I don't know why, but I mean, this seems like it might be tailored to that sort of thing, especially now that they're sort of, some of them are becoming, for lack of a better term, it seems like Americanized, you know, a little bit with the better quality production and all that stuff.
Yeah. And part of for Pistol, and you know, is that I've always seen it as a Western, because I heard you kind of say Western. I know you meant Western in a different way. But,
yeah, I know. I'm like, what am I talking about?
I always kind of saw it as a, you know, a Western. And sometimes I think of The Preacher, even though in no way are they the same, but I always love The Preacher. So I always like to talk about The Preacher, but, is this idea of just getting this righteous journey that you're going on, and, you know, and whether you're committing, you know, you're just like, I'm going forward, I'm going to do this thing, and wherever the cards kind of fall, they're going to fall. And, you know, but to me, she is kind of a Western vigilante character, you know, and that's, you know, and I think that, I don't know, I think that's very, I feel it's very cinematic, you know.
Yeah. It definitely would work in a different medium.
And we need
as well.
We have so many superheroes, and I love all the superhero movies, but I would like some alternate, you know, choices. Like,
sure.
I mean, and it's not that we don't have a ton. I mean, we have like,
We don't have a Latin Avenger yet.
We don't even have
a Latino Avenger yet.
That's
so.
Another reason I picked her, because we don't have enough women, but we don't have enough women of color, you know, and it's like, there needs to be more, you know, and it is very important. And it's, I'm on that, you know, we don't need less of other people, but we need more of the people who are missing. So,
Well, before we finish up, tell me about Wicked Tree Press. And you also have a book coming out that, are you self-publishing it or?
Right. I am Wicked Tree Press.
I love that. That was very confident.
I am Wicked Tree Press right now, but this is my, new company. And my goal is to also be publishing other writers and, artist. I've just gotten started, so we'll see. So because I came from screenwriting, I've always wanted to be a novelist, and I have now transitioned from, I still do screenplay writing, but I really want to focus on this kind of stuff. I'm traditionally very into science fiction and horror, so the superhero things, new as far as writing, is new to me. So my first novella, it's going to be a series, is coming out, and I'll have them at my small press booth at LA Comic Con. It's called Plastic Girl Evolution, and it is a story about, it's kind of a climate change, a dystopian story where only kids are alive, and there's not very many of them.
Oh, wow.
So you start with a young girl who has been living by herself on the shores of Lake Michigan, kind of surviving, and she has taken it upon herself to take care of the lake. Like, she just goes out and does these routines. Like, she looks for fish. She looks, you know, to find out if anything's alive. But she's very lonely. And she ends up discovering something one day that is basically like, you know, the next step in evolution, and becomes part of it. And it's kind of her adventure of what that is. And then there's also some other people that are, you know, going to cause her problems, but it's a very, and then my big book I'm in the middle of editing is a fantasy sci-fi kind of action adventure story for young adult. So that one's about a girl who's battling cancer, who goes to a fantasy world to kind of face her fear of death and facing it and all that kind of stuff.
No, that's great. That's what you should do as a writer. So is Plastic Girl for younger, Plastic Girl, right? Was that what it was?
Or Plastic Girl. It is not, it is not a young adult title. It is just, science fiction. Young people. The characters are young. I read it to my daughters. I'm a little more, it's got a little bit of, violence in it, and it's really dark. I mean, it's dark material, but it's a little hopeful. I mean, it's about the way we are with our climate, you know, and like needing to act about it before it's too late. So I would say that kids could read it from like fifth grade up, but it's not a young adult piece as of right now.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, that's great. And so you're going to be at Los Angeles Comic Con at the end of the month, it's towards the end of the month, correct?
Yeah. October 26th through 28th. And it's the, used to be Kamikaze, Stan Winston's Comic-Con. It likes to change names
Stan
every
year. Stan Lee's Comic-Con.
Sorry, you're right. I said the wrong one. Stan Lee's Comic-Con.
Yeah.
You guys. And so I'm going to do that. And
what's your booth number? Do you know off the top of your head?
You know what? They haven't emailed yet. I need I better find out.
You should get on that LA Comic-Con.
I am going to do a panel.
That's great.
On Saturday, October 27th, it's Publishing Your First Comic.
That's
so
great.
It's at 4:30. So yeah, I'm going to get to do a panel. So that should be fun.
Oh, that's exciting too. Oh, that's great. Congratulations. That's awesome. Well, I really appreciate you coming on to Part-Time Fanboy, Jessica. It's been really great chatting with you again, a second time.
I appreciate you having me. It was fun.
No.
I mean, and sex trafficking talk can be, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. As we vent our sort of liberal, our anxiety-ridden.
I think it's gone to, what are we, the angry mom now?
Yeah, we're the angry mom. We used to be snowflakes. Now we're the angry mom.
How do you transition to snowflakes to angry mom?
I don't know. Winter is coming. That's all I have to say, hopefully. Get out there and vote blue, people.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So, my name is Christian Horn, and this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. I have been on the show with Jessica Mason. Her book is Pistol. She has a book, an actual book with like text, not pictures, called Plastic Girl coming out. And you can find her at Los Angeles Comic Con at the end of October. Thank you so much, Jessica. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you so much.
Cool. And you can find Part-Time Fanboy at parttimefanboy.com, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all the lovely social media places. The email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. And we will be back soon with another episode. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.